Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today, a look at the contemporary American family farm. Journalist Ted Genoway spent a year following the Hammond family farm in east central Nebraska. The Hammonds grow corn and soybeans and raise cattle on land they've worked for generations. But in this last generation, the risks, which have always been a part of farming, have been growing. Agricultural industrial economics encourage farms to grow ever larger. Low crop prices mean razor-thin margins, and with more consumers wanting small-yield organic meats and produce, farmers are being pulled in two directions. Add to that concerns about groundwater depletion, climate change concerns, and shifting international trade policies, as well as farmers' traditional worries about weather and rain at the right times and amounts. It's small wonder that anyone would farm when so many of the criteria for success lay outside of the farmer's control. Ted Genoways is a contributing editor at Mother Jones and the New Republic and the author of The Chain, Farm Factory and the Fate of Our Food. His new book is titled This Blessed Earth, A Year in the Life of an American Family Farm. It's published by Norton. Ted Genoways, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me on.
This Blessed Earth follows Rick and Heidi Hammond's family farm and their daughter and now son-in-law in east central Nebraska from the harvest of 2014 to the harvest of 2015. What interests you in telling this story now?
Well, I guess I got started on this in part because as a journalist who covers the food industry and agriculture, I had seen this shift that I think we've all witnessed as people have become more concerned about where their food comes from and tried to move in the direction of becoming enlightened eaters who are concerned about an industry that is relying on chemicals for increased row crop production and antibiotics and feed additives for meat production. And yet what I saw was that people as consumers were really concerned about these things as they affected themselves and their families, and that they seemed to have this idea that it was an automatic good for everyone involved in the system if these things were reformed to be more sustainable and more healthful. And I guess I got to wondering how these changes were affecting especially smaller farmers who are already feeling the pinch from an industry that is encouraging them to grow and to take on more risk and more overhead every year, and wondering what it does for them when the whole competitive model is built around something that is chemical intensive and that is all about volume, at the same time that consumers are increasingly demanding things that are chemical free and are small scale and artisanal. And so my simple idea, which I have to admit I didn't just co-develop but kind of pilfered from my wife, who's a photographer, Marianne Andre, she had talked about following a farm family for a year to see these things. And the more we talked about it, the more it seemed to me that it wasn't something that you could just see visually, that it really required being able to talk to these families and to hear the kinds of stresses that they're facing to put those images into some kind of context.
So how are the Hammonds dealing with this two-pronged diversion here between increasing your yields? Yields are so important because the margin is so small on a lot of these family farms. And at the same time, there's this consumer demand for artisanal, organic, you know, touch by the farmer sort of produce and food.
That's right. It creates real challenges for them. I mean, the Hammonds have a split operation where they're raising row crops. They raise a rotation primarily of corn and soybeans. And at the same time, they're cattle ranchers. And the cattle operation, they've tried as much as possible to go over to antibiotic-free and to direct marketing to consumers in order to capture some of that premium from the way that they have sought to raise their cattle. But they've encountered real challenges, especially, you know, for farmers who have land in close to cities where they can bring their product into farmers markets and have a large consumer base readily available, that is something that's easier for them to do. For farmers and ranchers like the Hammonds, who live in a truly rural area, and the closest towns are communities of fewer than 10,000 people, it's much more difficult to have a big enough consumer base to sustain the operation, and certainly a consumer base large enough that you can command the kind of premiums that you would in a city.
Now, the Hammonds have a family farm, but it's a lot larger operation than, say, a family farm in that area would have been a generation ago. Can you compare the size of their what they farm and ranch today compared to what their family would have done a generation ago?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, the thing that's interesting, I mean, the numbers are pretty symmetrical, as I guess makes sense when you're talking about something that's kind of zero sum, like land. But over the last generation, somewhere close to 75% of people who were farming have left. They've sold their land and they've moved into town and have gone on to pursue other lives. At the same time, not surprisingly, the size of farm operations has, on average, grown about fourfold. And that's very much the case with the Hammonds. And they make for a kind of perfect case study because the land that Heidi inherited, and that then when Heidi and Rick got married, they started farming together. Because they had four kids, their ambition was to increase the size of the operation fourfold so that they could give each of the kids the same size operation that they had inherited, for them to grow and build on their own. The problem, of course, is that it's not possible when you've got a finite resource like land to keep having indefinite growth. And so a lot of what has ended up happening is not just acquiring more land, but finding new methods to make that land more productive and to intensify the yield that is coming off of each piece of ground.
Yeah, and they've increased their land quite a bit, and they describe it as, you know, the Johnson place, or, you know, it's all these
right.
amalgams of what used to be other family farms that they now farm.
Well, and I've said, you know, to me, there's this kind of ghost geography that is created in these rural areas where people talk about places in terms of people who are no longer there and refer to landmarks that are long gone. And you start to realize how rapidly this landscape has changed when all of these things that people use to navigate this sort of, as I say, geography that exists in their collective memories is no longer reflected on the land. And to me, that just shows the kind of rapid change that they're living under, but it also helps illustrate the kind of pressure that they're living with. That it is not at all conceptual when they talk about farm failures or the prospect of losing everything. Every single person knows multiple families that have gone bankrupt and had to have farm sales, and they just vanish from the land. They're never seen again after having spent generations in that place.
And Rick and Heidi, they really built a lot of their family farm, the land that they now own, on the last huge farm crisis in the late 80s, right? When land
yep.
prices basically collapsed, farmers had their loans called in, and he bought land on the cheap.
This is one of the things that is kind of an untold story of how these cycles go. When there are widespread failures, it causes land prices to crash, and it makes it possible for other farmers to take on that additional overhead and risk. And so it is a kind of boom and bust cycle. We're seeing it again, that right now crop prices are low, and it is pulling down property values, which is making it difficult for farmers to get loans and difficult for them to service existing loans. And more people are getting out now than they have in a generation, and the amount of debt that's being carried by each individual farmer is larger than it's been since the farm crisis. And what that almost certainly means is that as, once again, as farmers are forced out, that other farmers who have been more successful, both through care and through good luck, will increase the size of their operations and will gamble that their operations will be the winners going forward.
You know, we think of farmers being sort of the salt of earth, loath to take risk. What I found from this, at least of this family has taken a lot of risk over the years and over decades. You know, getting into the farming business at the height of the farm crisis, using the low prices to buy land. You know, it's a lot of hedging. You know, they use seed corn operations as a sort of a floor to make sure that their harvest is safe, you know, regardless of what happens with the weather and you know, the growing conditions. He's kind of like building all these hedges and taking sort of managed risk every single year.
That's exactly right. And that's how every operation really runs. I mean, farmers, for all of their reputation as extremely conservative, what they really are is risk takers. They're gamblers. And like any successful gamblers, what they really operate on is inside knowledge and years of experience. And yet, it, just like any gamble, boils down to good luck in the end, because you can build hedges against your bets. But in the end, what determines the outcome and the yield for a particular field is still, to some degree, determined by the rain and by whether your field gets hit by a storm, whether you have unexpected insect infestations or you get some sort of infection with the plants. I mean, there are the age-old factors that still go into it. And certainly we've come to a point where it's possible to make it so that the baseline that every field will attain is much higher than it used to be. There's less of a possibility of going completely bankrupt in a single season. But because of everyone's success, it means that the margins are narrower. And what ends up happening is not so much the cycle that we used to see, where there's suddenly widespread failures in a single year, but instead it's this kind of accrual of a debt that is built up over a number of years before it simply becomes unsustainable.
My guest today is Ted Genovese. He's a journalist and a contributing editor at Mother Jones and the New Republic, and his new book is titled This Blessed Earth, A Year in the Life of an American Family Farm. It's published by Norton. He follows the Hammond family farm in East Central Nebraska from the harvest of 2014 through the harvest of 2015. You follow the Hammond family at a critical time in the life of a family farm. Why was it such a critical time?
Well, the first factor, to be sure, is that Rick and Heidi are approaching an age where they're looking to retire from the operation, or at least take less of a hand in the day-to-day operations. And their kids are not really kids anymore. They're in their 20s and coming into their 30s and are in a position to take more responsibility and more ownership over the land. And so the year that I was on the farm, one of Rick's daughters, Megan, and her then fiance, now husband, Kyle, were in the process of moving back and assuming responsibility for their quarter of the inherited land and operation. And it was a moment that is always fraught in the life of any farm, where the older generation is having to loosen its grip on the reins and let the younger generation take over and probably make some mistakes and miscalculations. And the younger generation is having to step forward and assert itself and also then deal with the aggravations and the headaches of being second-guessed by the older generation and having them looking over your shoulder every time you make a mistake. I always say, I mean, I don't know how these families make this work. I think that two of the most fraught situations that anyone has to deal with is workplace dynamics and family dynamics. And when you have your family and your work completely commingled, it's the same group of people, and then get into a situation where you're so isolated that, you know, many of these families on any given day may only interact with their family members. And so it's a real pressure cooker. And when you introduce to that, that those complex dynamics are changing and that each generation is having to accept new responsibilities, revised responsibilities, it just makes for a difficult situation. But for me, as the writer trying to understand what's happening, it's inherently dramatic. And the Hammonds were really incredibly brave to allow not only me, but my wife with a camera there to document all of this as it happened.
They seem to be handling the transition well, but there was another critical issue, and that's that you're viewing them at a time a few years after crop prices were at all-time highs. During the middle part of the last decade, you know, it was not uncommon to see corn at $8 a bushel. These are levels we haven't seen in probably a long, long time. And you saw these record crop prices. Family farms were urged to use this as a way of expanding operations, replace equipment, use this windfall. And then, of course, crop prices have returned to regular prices with record harvests. So this is a critical time in farming across the country.
That's all exactly right. And we just happened to be there at the moment that this was all taking place. When my wife and I arranged with the Hammonds to be able to follow them around for a year, the prices were exactly as you described. They were, you know, between $7 and $8 a bushel for corn, around $15 for soybeans. And between the spring when we made the arrangements and the fall when we actually started following them around, crop prices fell by almost 50%. And as you said, all of these families had been encouraged to take on all sorts of new debt and had been able to get loans for that debt based on the expectation that land values would be going up with these soaring crop prices, and suddenly everything crashed. The bottom fell out of everything. And so we caught them at a moment where, as I said before, they're trying to make some transition from one generation to the next, and suddenly that rising generation and Megan and Kyle are having to make that transition in the midst of one of the most difficult financial times that farms have experienced in 30 or so years. And so it was an incredibly difficult situation. And what it does most of all is make it so that every farm can't afford to have a single thing go wrong. And of course, as soon as you say, you know, we need everything to go right for a year, everything starts to go wrong in even small ways. And that those small problems take on huge significance, and freighted with that significance, there's conflict in the family, and it's an incredibly difficult situation for them to be dealing with. But I was also just astounded at how fast they, as a family unit, and really as a working crew, were able to accept new realities and shift and adjust to them and to find ways to work together and work through problems. And also then that after you've had a moment where you're screaming at each other because you think that somebody has caused a problem not only for you but for the whole family, you work through that, you talk it out, and you keep going.
Yeah. You know, you mentioned they raise corn and soybeans on a rotating basis. Were you surprised by the level of technology used to raise these crops? I haven't been on a family farm since I was a kid, a wheat farm when I was a kid, And I was surprised at the level of technology in the cab was they're harvesting soybeans. You know, they're using GPS. They're using satellite imaging to determine how to put the rows. So they're using the least amount of fuel to service seed and harvest the crops. I was just really astounded by the level of technology.
Yeah, that was the greatest surprise for me, too. I mean, I knew that the technology was evolving fast and that things were becoming more and more high-tech all the time. I just hadn't really understood that we've reached a point where all of the planting is mapped out in advance. It is based on years of data that has been collected, not just for a region, but for a particular field and particular parts of a field. And so the planter knows, using the data that's been collected and programmed into it, where to plant more seeds and where to plant fewer. The farmer is able to determine how much fertilizer to apply, how much herbicide to apply. And again, not just to a whole field, but to particular regions of the field. And even the irrigation is becoming precise in that way, so that with the new generation of center pivots, they're not just massive sprinkler systems that are watering a whole field, but actually each segment, each individual hose is setting its flow according to how much water that part of the field needs at that moment through soil moisture testing, but also how much water has returned on yield in years past. And for farmers, somebody like Rick Hammond, who grew up in western Nebraska doing this sort of work as a kid in the 70s, to see the technology that has changed in this way over the years, where he's gone from using a hand-steered planter and harvester. If I remember correctly, it was a four-row harvester that Rick was using when he was young, to the kind of extremely sophisticated equipment that's required now has been an absolute revolution. And so, I mean, one of the other factors that doesn't get talked about nearly enough in this disappearance of farmers off the land is that for many of them, it was a rate of change and a steepness of a learning curve that was just insurmountable. And many have chosen to go do something else, which leaves behind the people who are the real, not just risk takers, but innovators and people who are really able to adapt to these changes quickly and master them.
My guest today is Ted Genoese. His new book is titled This Blessed Earth, A Year in the Life of an American Family Farm. He followed the Hammond family farm in east central Nebraska for a year from the harvest of 2014 to the harvest of 2015. Well, what are the threats to farmers like the Hammonds today? As you write in the epilogue, with the Trump presidency, the plan to pull out of the TPP, Trans-Pacific Partnership, they're worried about grain deals drying up with China. They're worried about all sorts of things you wouldn't think farmers are really worried about. And world politics, everything affects this family farm.
Absolutely. The farmer of today, especially the commodity farmer, has to be aware of all of these international policies, the trade deals, and what the outlook is for them. You not only have to be skilled in all the ways that farmers were in past generations in terms of your knowledge of the land and your ability to repair a piece of equipment and that sort of thing, but you also have to be a commodities trader. You have to be able to make decisions about market projections and what's happening with new hybrid seed technology, where you think you can capture some part of the market better than your competitors, and where you think that market will be cresting 6 months down the road when harvest comes along. And one of the challenges that farmers face more and more also is that everybody is good at this. everybody has the same data available to them. You know, there's been some coverage lately about the fact that, we finally had the first year where there were more soybeans harvested in the U.S. than corn. And that has entirely to do with farmers making a calculation about soybean prices, which have been more stable than corn prices, and soybean yields, which have been increasing more over the years where corn yields have kind of plateaued. And so there's more profit to be captured, but there's also more competition. And so it is all of those challenges in the field at the same time that they're having to keep an eye on, you know, what's going on with, as you said, TPP, or what's going on with the U.S.-Korea Free Trade Agreement, or what's happening with NAFTA. And the real problem that the farmers have faced with the Trump administration is that Trump's whole idea of negotiating style is to create chaos, to create uncertainty, and then to try to capitalize on that uncertainty. The problem is that for farmers, what they're looking for is, as we've said, ways of hedging their bets and ways of introducing a little bit of certainty into an uncertain system. And so when Trump threatens to cancel NAFTA, which accounts for, you know, 20 or 25% of our exports of corn and soybeans, that creates a serious problem for American farmers, because they don't know if there's going to be an available export market. They don't know how much to plant or which crop to plant. And again, in a system that has very narrow margins, there's always the possibility that just the uncertainty itself is enough to push a year from a thin profit over into debt.
Hmm. Well, it's an interesting book. Ted, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks again for having me on. I've really enjoyed it.
Journalist Ted Genoways is the author of This Blessed Land, A Year in the Life of an American Family Farm. It's published by Norton. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.
The University of Tulsa welcomes the Greater Tulsa community to a wide array of athletic events, artistic performances, exhibitions, academic lectures, and symposia held on campus. Our public events are open to all. Requests for accommodation of disabilities may be directed to Dr. Tawny Taylor at 918-631-2315. To ensure availability of an interpreter, 5 to 7 days' notice is needed. 48 hours is recommended for all other accommodations.